Smith, and I'm the Director of Women's Studies. On behalf of the Women's Studies Program, the Institute for Research on Women and Gender, and the Michigan Initiative in Women's Health, I want to welcome you to this, the second annual Vivian R. Shaw Lecture. The Vivian R. Shaw Lecture Series has been made possible by a generous gift from Ellen Hagar, a 1958 graduate of the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, who is currently Senior Vice President and Deputy General Counsel for Communications for News America Publishing, Incorporated. Ellen donated her gift to the Women's Studies Program and the Institute for Research on Women and Gender in honor of her mother, Vivian R. Shaw, who died of breast cancer at age 50 when Ellen was a junior here at Michigan. To honor her mother, Ellen specifically wanted this lecture series to bring to campus scholars and public figures who would address a real issue, a real life issue affecting the lives of women and girls. It is especially appropriate, then, that this year the Vivian R. Shaw Lecture is part of a year-long series of public lectures on women's health, historical perspectives, and policy dilemmas. This series of public lectures has been made possible by a broad coalition of co-sponsors, bringing diverse campus units together to support discussion of women's health in historical perspective and in its policy implications. And you may want to refer to the back of the program. It lists the co-sponsors of the series itself. At the inaugural Vivian R. Shaw Lecture last year, Ellen's daughter, Emily, was present to introduce her mother. Tonight, Emily, now a senior here at Michigan, double majoring in musical theater and in psychology, returns once again to honor her grandmother by introducing her mother. Please join me in welcoming the granddaughter of Vivian R. Shaw, Emily Vivian Agress.
Thank you very much. Hello. I have been given the incredible honor for the second year in a row to introduce the woman who has made this entire event possible. My mother and mentor, Ellen Agress. My mother never ceases to amaze me. Although she managed to fulfill a full-time executive career, she also was able to be a full-time mother to both my brother and I. She is by far the smartest person I know. I'll confess I still send her my papers to proofread. She has also been an inspiration, not only to me and my family, but also to many young women. She has set a powerful example of how far women can go, both in the professional world and in the home. Vivian R. Lecture Series is meaningful to me on a few different levels. First, it helps me preserve the memory of my grandmother, Vivian, who I never had the opportunity to meet. Second, it allows myself, other students, and members of the community become further educated in important women's issues. And third, my mother's endowment sets an example to all women of how important it is to acknowledge issues concerning women. So with no further ado, may I introduce the woman I look up to, admire, and love, my mother, Ellen Shaw Agress.
Liberation, we seem to be more hung up on our physical attributes than ever.
I'm sure tonight's address will give us some insight into our body projects that will help us to understand and deal with this preoccupation in our own lives and in the lives of our friends, our sisters, and our daughters. And finally, I want to reiterate a pitch that I made last year on female philanthropy. Women, even those who support it, just don't contribute as much money as men do to nonprofit institutions and causes. Because money talks, this means that issues of concern to women often don't get the attention they deserve. I know philanthropy is the furthest thing from the minds of students who are struggling to pay for room, board, and tuition. But someday you'll have discretionary dollars. And when you do, I urge you to devote some portion of them to the support of an institution or an issue that means something to you. It will make a difference, and take it from me, it will also make you feel good. I want to thank Abby Stewart and Sydney Smith for again organizing a wonderful evening, Joan Brumberg for agreeing to give tonight's lecture, and all of you for attending. I'm very excited to see so many people here. Thank you very much.
Well, it's my turn. I'm Abby Stewart, Director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender, and I'm delighted to welcome this wonderful family back to Ann Arbor. And my special job and pleasure is to welcome Joan Brumberg to Ann Arbor and to tell you a little bit about her before she tells us about the Body Project. The range and breadth of Professor Brumberg's knowledge and expertise will, I think, be made clear to you by many things, but one indicator is the fact that she is currently the Stephen Weiss Presidential Fellow and Professor of History, Human Development, and Women's Studies at Cornell University. That's a very unusual package to be a professor of all three of those things. And her books make obvious how deep and wide is her knowledge in these different fields and others, like medicine. She's taught at Cornell since completing her education at the University of Rochester, Boston College, and the University of Virginia. Most of us in this room know Professor Brumberg as the author of The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls. And we do have it here, courtesy of Shane Drum, and you're invited to meet with Professor Brumberg after the lecture. If you'd like to have her sign your book or talk to her a little bit more. Many of you probably also know that she's the author of Fasting Girls, The Emergence of Anorexia Nervosa as a Motor Disease, and Mission for Life, The Judson Family, and American Evangelical Culture. She has truly distinguished herself as an authority both on the experience of adolescence among girls and a particular developmental vulnerabilities girls face. The hallmark of her work is the combination of rich psychological insight, acute social analysis, and creative historical research, all delivered in the books with a beautiful writing style. In her recent work, she is clearly interested in the ordinary vicissitudes of adolescence for girls in contemporary America as well as in the past. She retains, though, a concern about the potential for the deeper trouble that some girls end up in, as she was exploring in Fasting Girls and Anorexia. Professor Brumberg has been recognized with teaching awards from her institution, as well as by a Guggenheim Fellowship, grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and Rockefeller Foundation, as well as a McDowell Colony residency. She's worked on a number of public history projects, I think part of her commitment to the broader issues of citizenship that some academics are concerned about. She's consulted on a film project on the history of Girl Scouts, an exhibit on the history of asylums in New York State, and historical site interpretation for museum educators. She's currently working on a project on girls' diaries, which doesn't surprise me at all, because she used girls' diaries in the Body Project with great success. So I know I'm looking forward to her new work. Meanwhile, I'm eager, as I'm sure you are, to hear what she has to say tonight, because I know many people have shared my own experience of having read The Body Project and having found that Linda Kerber was correct when she wrote on a book journal that Joan Jacob Brumberg tells a stunning and troubling story. What is even more important, though, is that she not only tells us a fascinating and disturbing story, but she has some important ideas about how we might do better in providing what adolescent girls need to survive. She made me feel it was urgent that we figure out how to do that, So now I'd like to welcome her to the lectern so we can hear what she has to say.
Connections between Michigan and Cornell, having admitted women about the same time. And it's a delight to see how strong and vital your opportunities are here for the study of gender at both the center and in women's studies. So it's really nice for me. And I want to thank also, I'm delighted to be part of the Jeanine Shaw Lecture Series. So let me start. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for a while, and then I'm going to show some slides, and then I'm going to come back and talk a little bit more to give you a roadmap. A century ago, American women were lacing themselves into corsets and teaching their adolescent daughters to do the same thing. But today's teens, some with rings in their eyebrows and noses, shop for thong bikinis on their own, and their middle-class parents are likely to be uninvolved until the moment when the credit card bill arrives in the mail. Now, this transition in the experience of young women tells us a great deal about what's happened to female adolescents in the contemporary world. It's also kind of a useful imaginative backdrop for my remarks to you this evening, which are based on The Body Project, an intimate history of American girls. A little bit of intellectual biography first. In 1988, when I published Fasting Girls, which was a book about the history of anorexia nervosa, I was already thinking about the relationship between American culture and adolescent female bodies. Those who've read the book know that cultural imperatives, particularly the link in the 20th century between slimness and female perfection, are an important part of my explanation of the increasing incidence of eating disorders. However, although my work is very much in the social constructionist vein, I never argued that anorexia nervosa was caused by culture alone. There clearly are some intervening personal, psychological, and familial variables that explain the etiology of anorexia nervosa as well as other eating disorders. But in the years since the publication of Fasting Girls, I gave a great deal of thought to what it is about American culture that makes female adolescence so difficult. Important work by Carol Gilligan, Mary Pfeiffer, Peggy Orenstein, the Sadkers, I'm sure some of you have read this material. It all sounds a clear alarm. For American girls, more so than boys, adolescence is a time of declining confidence, silence, and danger. And many of you in the audience may also be familiar with the unsettling fact that studies show that until puberty, women really are the healthier sex by all measures, mental health measures as well as biomedical measures. Now, because so much contemporary social science literature suggests that the body is a serious problematic for girls beginning in puberty, I decided to focus my attention on the adolescent female body, to give it a history, and to map the ways in which the inevitable physical transformations of this stage of life have been negotiated in different generations of American girls. So instead of writing a history of bulimia, which some people expected me to do, I moved away from pathology to normative experience. My new book rests on the assumption that the female adolescent body has a history, maybe a distinctly American one, and that what happens to girls in the process of physical and emotional development changes to some extent over time. I say to some extent because I want to acknowledge the tension between what is hardwired into the organism and into the developmental process and what is culturally constructed. Unlike other history books, I begin with a biological event, and that event is menarche, the first period. And the narrative then moves through a profoundly important sequence of physical developments, such as the appearance of breasts, the eruptions of acne, the emergence of sexuality. Body parts usually don't appear in works of history, unless they're lost on the battlefield, but they're critical to my interpretation of what's happened to girls in the course of the past century. Among other things, I suggest that some body parts have all but disappeared, such as the hymen, what the Victorians called the meaningful membrane, while new ones, such as the bikini line area, have been acquired. Nobody in my generation worried about that one very much. In essence, I use the strategies and the techniques of a social and cultural historian to show how the body projects and preoccupations of girls have changed in different generations, and how and why American girls came to understand the body as a critical personal resource, a social symbol, and the penultimate source of self-identity. So I want to begin tonight with a simple but very important comparison. At the end of the last century, in the 1890s, a middle-class American girl was likely to menstruate 15 or 16 and be a blushing virgin when she married, usually in her early 20s. In contrast, in the 1990s, a girl of the same social class is likely to be sexually active before the age at which her great-great-grandmother even began to menstruate. This is an enormous life course change that has meaning for girls' bodies and for their social experience. Now, although most people think of the biology of the human body as relatively fixed and static from one generation to the next, the bodies of female adolescents in America have in fact changed over time, largely as a result of improved nutrition combined with the decline in infectious diseases. Today, American girls follow a new biological timetable, by that I mean earlier menarche, as well as a new social timetable, by that I mean earlier age of first intercourse, but the combination of the two, earlier physical maturity and greater autonomy and freedom, has not necessarily worked to their advantage. Now, my reading of the situation of contemporary versus historic girls is based on an analysis of over 150 personal diaries written by adolescent girls ages 13 to 18 in the years between the 1830s and the 1990s. And as I read, I asked, what was it like to develop breasts or begin your periods a century ago? What role did mothers, families, physicians, and the community play in the transition from girlhood into adult womanhood? And how did girls in the past think about their changing bodies as they negotiated their way into adulthood? Now, at the outset, with an acute audience like this at the University of Michigan, I have to acknowledge that there is a class bias in my sample. Diary keeping in adolescence has almost always been a middle class activity for a variety of reasons that have to do with affluence, privacy, who had a room of her own, and styles of nurture. Middle class diaries are also, if you think about it, more likely to survive because of collecting policies in historical repositories, museums, and historical societies, which are biased in favor of community elites. What's interesting, though, about the epidemiology of diaries is that they appear regularly among different ethnic minorities, Jews, African Americans, Italians, Asians, at that moment in the family history when the family has achieved middle class status. For example, among American Jews, a few daughters of immigrants kept diaries in the 1920s, but the real explosion of Jewish girl diaries came in post-World War II America as a result of increased affluence and probably also the influence of Anne Frank, whose diary was published in 1952. Among African Americans, the girl diaries of the early 20th century are also linked by social class status. Everyone that I have seen was the daughter of a teacher or a preacher. In other words, the backbone of the African American middle class. Now, as emotionally intimate as diaries can be, girl diarists in America had been fairly silent on the subject of the body until the early 20th century. For example, a century ago, menarche, the first period, was a private affair for women and girls, and they handled it with enormous reserve. Some Victorian adolescents made brief comments about being unwell, that's a term that still survives, I think, or they repeated a cryptic pattern of X's, sentence on the top of the page every 28 or 30 days I had to count to realize what was going on. And some wrote MP for menstrual period. In the early 1890s, Lou Henry, a 15-year-old Pasadena schoolgirl, who would later become Mrs. Herbert Hoover, noted that her mother made her stay home on the lounge all day and that she was excused from gym, she said, for reasons best known to myself. This sparse commentary suggests that the mom, Mrs. Hoover, limited Lou's activity, that she was monitored during her period, and that the high school made allowances for girls on those special days. So this is kind of the historical origins of the gym excuse. Intimacies with young men were also hidden or coded subjects in the 19th century. Consider, for example, Antha Warren, a young woman who taught school in St. Albans, Vermont, back in the 1860s. When she was in her late teens, Antha began keeping company with Henry Munsell, a young dentist who was a Civil War vet. Whenever the couple kissed, Antha put an asterisk in her diary. And since Henry came to call at least 4 or 5 nights a week, these asterisks mounted up. One night she wrote with some satisfaction, "Too many to count." Antha's tone suggested that she took pleasure from her growing intimacy with Henry, whom she married in 1870, and that the couple may have done more than kiss. Yet she always wrote about her interactions in a coded way, either because she feared that her diary might be read by others, or more likely, I think, because she did not have the vocabulary or the language to describe what was happening to her. Listen to this entry. She writes, "After tea, Henry and I went into the parlor, shut the door, and had a visit. He tried to sleep in my lap, but couldn't. Had such a good time," and then she draws 4 squiggly lines and writes, "buttons." I was left wondering. Did Henry simply play with her buttons, or did they engage in what would come to be called petting in the 1920s? Now, most American girls were as reticent as Antha Warren and Lou Henry until the 20th century. But I want to give you some examples that map some of the changes in girls' ability to talk about their own sexuality. By the 1920s, I've jumped ahead now from the 1860s to the 1920s, so I've covered a bit of time. A sophisticated 18-year-old by the name of Yvonne Blue, later Mrs. B.F. Skinner, wrote about an evening necking and petting in the backseat of a car in a Chicago suburb. "I'm technically still a nice girl," she explained. But she vacillated between feeling guilty and happy about her experiences, and she writes, "Once in a while, I feel slightly ashamed of myself for indulging in the greatest American sport. But something must be the matter with me, because while I think it's wrong, I think it's written in caps and bold and underlined and apostrophes, you know, the way adolescent girls often do. So she says, while I think it's wrong, I really, really can't feel that it is. Underlined." Now, by the 1950s, jumping ahead 30 years, younger adolescent diarists such as Ruth Teichman, a 13-year-old in Queens. I actually got this diary from a New York City sanitation worker who found it in a garbage can. It's an interesting story, and I'd be happy to talk about how I get diaries later. Anyway, Ruth displayed an open curiosity about sex and some linguistic evidence of training in anatomical language. In other words, she had some sex ed. She writes about a pajama party where the girls pretended to be having sex with the boys, and she says very nonchalantly, "Robin put a wetted piece of toilet paper into Kathy's vagina," and then she goes on to describe what they ate. Okay. Jelly, pizza. But the language is important. By the 1980s, American girls were writing graphic accounts of their initiation into heterosexual relationships. This is where my age shows. I always take a deep breath before I have to read the rest of this. Although some girls were almost clinical in the reporting, others still use colloquialisms for body parts. For example, Gabby Brown, a 16-year-old who attended Catholic school in Michigan, Ypsilanti, I believe, wrote, "He wanted me to put my hands on his biwa, and when I did, he told me I made him happy." In Florida, 16-year-old Laura Ramirez wrote about her first real boyfriend, and this is all one sentence, so I'm reading it the way she wrote it. "He did what I guess you would call finger coitus for about 25 minutes, and neither of us said anything during the whole time. It was fantastic, and I enjoyed it immensely." The point is, from a historical perspective, these behaviors probably are not new, right? But having girls talk about them, even to themselves, is revolutionary. And what I would want to add as an important addendum here, that in the same era, in the 1970s, writing about lesbian relationships begins to appear for the first time in the adolescent diary, usually among girls who are somewhat older, 18 or 20. And there's quite an interesting coming out diary in The Body Project. But my book, The Body Project, is about more than this, I think, rather well-known from sexual repression to sexual expression. It's also about the evolution of a new way of thinking, a paradigm shift, if you will, that's had critical importance for the psychological development of adolescent girls. And to make my point, I'm going to turn again to the voices of girls themselves, but this time to two young women who made New Year's resolutions that were separated by almost a century. The first one is a Victorian young woman, 16 years old, in Boston. And the date is January 1, 1892. And she writes, "Resolve not to talk about myself or feelings, to think before speaking, to work seriously, to be self-restrained in conversations and actions, not to let my thoughts wander, to be dignified, interest myself in others." And notice there, the emphasis on internal character, but outward behavior as a reflection of internal character, and also the affiliative nature, the connected nature of that comment. She wants to be connected to other people. I mean, in some ways, it's a Gilligan-esque example. And you find that over and over again in diaries from this period. Now, a New Year's resolution written in 1982 provides a stark contrast. This is a young woman, 16 years old, from Stuyvesant High School in New York City. Some of you may know that that's a selective school in New York. She writes, "I will try to make myself better in any way I possibly can with the help of my budget and babysitting money. I will lose weight, get new lenses, already got a new haircut, good makeup, new clothes, and accessories." I mean, notice here the faith in visual presentation of the self, the emphasis on the outside of the body, and the need to consume in order to buy, in order to be better. And I'd also add that I think it's a highly individualistic strategy as opposed to an affiliative one. The contrast between these two girlish voices, one projecting good works and the other good looks, captures a critical change in the experience of America's adolescent girls over the past 100 years. Now, this is not to say that girls in the 19th century didn't care about their looks. Their diaries, in fact, reveal that they paid close attention to their hair and skin in particular. Margaret Fuller, one of my favorite 19th century feminists, apparently did battle with adolescent acne. Lou Henry Hoover, who I mentioned to you before, spent a great deal of time with her girlfriends in the 1890s learning how to bang her hair. It was in the 1890s, I think, that adolescent women discovered that you could hide kind of a row of adolescent zits with a ruffle of hair. She was very involved in that. But in the 19th century, beauty imperatives for young women were kept in check by considerations of moral character and by some harsh patterns of emotional denial and repression. Victorian girls often noted in their diaries when they, you know, acquired something new and pretty, such as a hair ribbon or a lace collar, but these purchases were not linked to their self-worth in the same ways that they are today. In fact, girls who were preoccupied with their looks were likely to be accused of vanity or self-indulgence. Many parents tried to limit their daughters' interest in these superficial things, such as hairdos or the size of their waists, because character was considered far more important than beauty. So another way of saying this is that before the 20th century, at least from their writing, girls simply did not organize their thinking about themselves around the body. But at the end of the 20th century, adolescent girls regard the body as their primary project. Today, many worry about the contours of their bodies, especially its size, shape, and muscle tone, because they believe that the body is the ultimate expression of the self. Their diaries reveal that when they're unhappy with something at school, in the family, or in relationships, they turn routinely to a form of self-critique that centers on the body, what clinicians call body angst, or I like this term better, bad body fever. And what I mean by that is a continuous internal dialogue with the self about what's wrong with, and you can fill in the blank, right? Your weight or a particular body part. And I would suggest from a historical perspective that the body part can change over time. Today, this kind of bad body fever is expressed, you know, routinely in girl talk and on TV programs in the afternoon. People talk about thunder thighs, about arm alarms, about butt bummers. My students have told me that there are even more of kind of formulations like this. Now, adolescent girls today face the issues girls have always faced. Who am I? Who do I want to be? But their answers, more than ever before, revolve around the body. The increase in anorexia nervosa and bulimia in the past 30 years suggests that in some cases the body becomes an obsession, leading to recalcitrant eating behaviors that can result in death. But even among girls who never develop eating disorders, the body is still central today to definitions of the self. Although there are some class and race differences, most clinicians note that body angst is high among contemporary young women. And the most recent poll suggests that 78% of American girls are dissatisfied with their bodies by the time they're 17. And pediatricians routinely are telling me that there are more and more girls who are coming in to at 8 or 9 and complaining that they are too fat or they are already on diets. So why is the body still a girl's nemesis? Shouldn't today's sexually liberated girls feel better about themselves than their corseted sisters of a century ago? Well, from the perspective of history, I think that adolescent self-consciousness is probably quite persistent, but that its level is raised or lowered like the water level in a pool by the cultural and social setting. Although young women today enjoy greater freedom and more options than their counterparts a century ago, I believe that they're also under more pressure and at greater risk because of the unique combination of biological and cultural forces that have made coming of age or growing up in a female body extremely difficult at the end of the 20th century. The fact that American girls now make the body their central project is not then an accident or a curiosity. In fact, it's a symptom of historical changes that have accumulated over time, making contemporary girls more anxious than ever before about their bodies and therefore about themselves. Now, in order to demonstrate the ways in which the pressure on girls' bodies has escalated and intensified over the past century, I'm going to turn now to some visual images. And these images really convey the nature and the direction of social change for girls in the 20th century. And they, in effect, tell the story of what's happened from corsets to body piercings. I've also thought about this slideshow in a way as an exhibition that could be called something like Landmarks in the History of Girls' Bodies. You might want to move into the middle if there's some extra space. Give me time to get it. There we go. This is an ad from a And I show it to you to make this point, that there are some ways in which girls will always be girls. In other words, there are ways in which we can put the emphasis on continuity as well as change. Hair, for example, has always been a perfect way for girls to say something about themselves. Hair is, after all, personal, but it's also malleable. And it's personal but public, and it's also malleable. Hair is one of a number of body projects that I talk about in terms of their changing meaning for adolescents. And this slide shows a girl with that long, luxuriant Victorian hair looking in a mirror. And I'm going to return to the subject of mirrors in a moment. Note that someone on the right in the corner is helping this young woman groom her hair. It could be a mother, it could be a sister. I would suggest it could even be a domestic servant. Next, you're going to see an unusual series of a single girl, one girl, Hattie Cooper, growing up in California at the end of the 19th century. What's interesting here is that you see her at 12, 16, and 18 in just a moment, and it demonstrates the pattern of what happens to hair in the 19th century. The pattern of long hair to hair up on the head at 16, and then at 18 to the hair up, but also the corseted body. Which is a feature of adolescent growth and development in that time period. Now, if we jump ahead to the 1920s, young women look quite different. This is the bob. You all have seen pictures like this. This is an anonymous American girl. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote about the bob, and everybody seems to have done it. It had a lot of symbolic value in terms of signaling modernity, and it fit with the new chemise silhouette of the flapper in the 20s. But if you, in my book, I suggest that it also means something else. Long hair, such as the hair I showed you in the first slide, required grooming, brushing, combing, braiding, and that was generally done at home, usually in the evening in the company of one's mother and sisters. In other words, it was a great deal of mutual grooming. And the bob really meant a break in the mother-daughter connection. Hairstyles obviously have political meaning. By the late 1960s and early 1970s, many African-American women had rejected the kind of hair straightening and processing products promoted in this ad. And note, this is for mothers and daughters to use together. Instead, in this time period, they chose a more natural look as a symbol of pride in race and African origins. And their use of natural close-cropped hair was, oppositional. It was a rejection of mainstream white beauty standards. And this use of hair as symbol continues today. This haircut on a student of mine, she explained it to me as a rejection of traditional femininity. Now, in the Body Project, I also talk about the history of menstruation. And the history of menstruation is important for what's happened to girls in their bodies. This is an 1897 ad from the Sears and Roebuck catalog. Tells us a lot about menstrual technology at the end of the 19th century. In the second column, you see a series of sanitary belts, and then also an early ad for mass-produced napkins. Menstruation was rarely acknowledged publicly in this era, and most women still made their own napkins from extraneous cloth that they collected in a rag bag and then washed by hand. Only women of some means would have been able to buy napkins like this at this point in time. And I guess I should say to those in the audience who are under 30 that the world before paper tape was very different. And you had to secure a napkin, to a belt. And this was a fixture of female life for a very long time. I trace the scientific and commercial transformations in menstrual practices and its effects on girls. By 1917, the time of this ad, there was a sanitary products industry, and those on top are rubber aprons that you wore underneath your clothes and on top of, pretty hot, I would think. By the 1920s, a trade journal for drugstores show the druggist how to display these heretofore unmentionable products, and notice what it says, whispering never built a business. increasingly, as menstruation was demystified, In other words, as it was spoken about more and more in women's magazines, you begin to see ads like this, where the mother and daughter are engaged in the critical conversation. And usually, the company, usually Kotex, is saying, if you don't know what to say to your daughter, write to us for a pamphlet, and we will provide you with the language. This ad from the 1920s also features that critical mother-daughter connection, but notice the daughter looks a little surly. I think it's meant to suggest that she's, they didn't use the term then, but she is a sexually active teen. And the product, Lysol, interestingly enough, and I do not recommend this, Lysol was used as a vaginal douche at this time. So that Lysol is also sending out pamphlets for mothers and daughters. This ad also plays to the mother-daughter connection, which is there but not there. Mothers who don't know how to talk to their daughters, looking for a third party to help them. In this case, this is an ad from the American Girl magazine for Girl Scouts. And it's aimed at the girl whose mother isn't talking, right? It says, your mother hems and haws, write to us. Will provide you with the information on menstruation. Now, this ad from 17 in the 1970s is a telling indication of social change. The mother has disappeared, right? And there's a new kind of menstrual product, a tampon for internal protection. Again, there are enormous generational differences here among women, even in this audience, on this particular dimension. Tampon use by teens well into the 1960s was not regarded favorably. The church, Catholic Church, took an active position against internal protection. All of this, of course, means that the hymen is losing its sanctity, virginity is declining in importance, but so are mothers. And here are the real source of information about female bodies is a girlfriend whose mother conveniently happens to be a nurse. I think what's important here about the image is it's a girl without a sexual mentor, despite the increasing permissiveness of society. Now, in my book, I argue that we have in America a culturally constructed menstrual script. By that, I mean that it really is an American way to menstruate. And learning how to do that was important to different generations of immigrants. There are, however, some very interesting ethnic differences in cultures where the connections between mothers and girls around their bodies are still quite strong. This ad for tampons is from a contemporary Spanish language magazine and still acknowledges the mother's traditional role as counselor and sex educator. Now, the American Girls Body Projects have also been influenced by two important developments that I outline and talk about in some detail in my book. The first is new and emerging opportunities for self-scrutiny. We're back to mirrors. We're going to be talking about mirrors in a minute. And also the shift from external control of the body, epitomized in the corset, to internal control represented by dieting and aerobics. All right, so I want to go back to this issue of self-scrutiny. I explore the impact of new technology, such as mass-produced mirrors, advertised by Sears in the 1880s, as well as the modern bathroom. I wish I had a better slide to make my point. But lights, mirrors, and running water have contributed to both improved hygiene, but also much closer scrutiny of women's faces. The modern bathroom is a very important site for American girlhood. And when the domestic bathroom scale is added to this, and it becomes a fixture of American middle class life after World War II, women and girls' attention to their weight escalates. Before the bathroom scale, most women were not aware of the number that they were. In other words, they didn't fixate on having an identity through weight. Now, I also considered the role of movies and their influence on girls. This early ad for Kleenex demonstrates that the new movie stars of the teens and 20s were role models for girls. By 1920, even nice middle-class girls began to use cosmetics and play with their appearance in ways that they never had before in Victorian America. So the point here is this, that by the early 20th century, self-scrutiny was not devalued in women. In fact, certain forms of vanity were now part of modern femininity, such as looking at yourself in a small handheld mirror known as a compact. These were marketed cheaply by 1925. By 1927, when this Ladies Home Journal cover appeared, the compact had a woman looking at her face on the street like this had become an icon for the era. I mean, 50 years before, a woman who did this would either be considered a lunatic or a lady of the night. I mean, it was just not something that nice women did in public. Now, the mandate for self-scrutiny intensified by the 1950s. I include this for everybody in my generation. This is from 17 in 1956 or 1957. And this slide points to the elaboration of the market for mirrors. There are more and more mirrors to consume, and they're increasingly specialized. There are makeup mirrors, full-length mirrors, magnifying mirrors, three-sided mirrors, you name it. And I think we are one of the few cultures in the world where you can get into an elevator and have a mirror on the ceiling, or go to the bathroom and have mirrors all around you while you're even seated on the toilet. Now, mirrors provide a good segue into my next subject, which is acne. And, you know, really, until you could see your pimples, they were merely tactile. They were not a visual problem for you. Acne is an inevitable part of adolescence, but even pimples, I argue, change their meaning over time. In the late 19th century, when this photo was taken for a medical text, pimples were still connected to sexual sin and perversion, masturbation and syphilis in particular. Later, adolescent blemishes were regarded as a sign of uncleanliness and as an emblem of lower class status. Now, I find it very interesting that pimples seem to have always had more cultural meaning for girls than boys. What I mean by that is that girl pimples get more attention than boy pimples, and we can figure that out from looking at the records of early dermatologists and who was there in the waiting room. I mean, who's investing their money in this new imperative to fix the skin for health, but also for beauty? And black girls, of course, have had to deal with the double burden of pigment, color, and also pimples. And I traced the changing skincare experience of American girls, giving some attention to race products that promised, like this one, to whiten the skin. By the 1950s, this imperative for improved health, but also beauty, the mingling of these two, really absorbed middle-class parents. And doctors, advertisers, everybody was waging war against acne in the 50s. They also realized that baby boom pimples were very big business. This Clearasil Personality of the Month campaign was one of the most successful advertising campaigns in post-World War America. It was always the same story. Some of you may remember this. The girl who's using the product has pimples. She uses the product, she triumphs over pimples, and she becomes popular at school. But what I never realized when I was reading these as a girl, of course, was that the Clearasil Personality of the Month never had an ethnic name. She was never even a McNamara, but she certainly was not a Goldberg or a Zuccarelli. She certainly was not a woman of color. Now, American middle-class parents made enormous investments in the skin of their daughters, and I use the social history of acne to talk about the ways in which beauty and physical and mental health concerns have all merged so that Americans today basically believe more than ever before in the perfectibility of the human body. And I would point to the rising tide of plastic surgeries in this country as a good indication of that. But there's another important development in this story of the 20th century, and that has to do with hygiene. And the point I would want to make with this audience tonight is that modern hygiene means that the body requires more, not less, upkeep and expenditure. So I'm going to move quickly through some slides to show you how the pressure has escalated from dental hygiene in the early 19th century, when teeth were a very important indication of social status, to underarm hair in the 1920s, an ad for one of the early depilatories, Zip, to leg care in the 50s. I had one of these pink lady chicks, electric razor. And a friend of mine who's a historian of women gave me this slide of her daughter's sixth grade class all shaving their, the girls shaving their legs together. And I showed this recently last year in Japan, and people thought it was really exotic. But I think it's so much a part of our culture that we don't even think about the extent to which girls in early adolescence begin to do some of these things together in a group. Body odor, okay? A major concern in the 50s with the enormous push for heterosexuality. Fashionable correction of eyesight, another kind of beauty health issue. What's interesting to me, and I never really thought about this until fairly recently, is that eyeglasses were not gendered until after World War II. Most of the eyeglasses are androgynous before World War II. After the war, there tend to be boy glasses and girl glasses, and of course we also move into contact lenses. Look magazine in the 50s, lenses were by and large invented for men to improve their performance in airplanes during the war, at sport, hunting and fishing, but it's very clear by the late 50s that the major market is going to be adolescent women who are doing this for both beauty slash improved eyesight. Orthodonture, of course, is another middle class investment that involves both the mingling of beauty and health concerns, weight loss camps, back in the New York Times, you're probably familiar with these. Again, my point being more and more upkeep here, more and more expenditure and time and energy. This is a new procedure that I just learned about, permanent makeup called micropigmentation. You can have your eyeliner drawn on forever. In many ways, it's like decorating or tattooing. And finally, you know, the most popular plastic surgery in America today is liposuction, and also something called Botox, which I cannot explain to you. And if there's somebody in the audience who can explain it to me, I'm not quite certain what it is, but I just read something about that. Now, a final point here in these slides. In the late 19th century, in this ad, okay, this is an ad for ham, and it makes an important point. And it makes a point about changing aesthetics. That is the way in which different parts of the body are valued or fetishized by different historical periods. In the 1890s, a small waist was important, so girls endured tight lacing. By the First World War, legs were getting much more cultural attention and exposure. This is a postcard that was sent by a Cornell student, a male, to a woman student at Wells College, which is up the road east. And notice how this card legitimates the male gaze and the interest in women's body parts. Also, I'm showing you this one, also a postcard, just to make the point that weight was not yet a private matter. The way it is for most women today. Most women today would rather give away their social security number than the number on the scale. And a lot of young women in the 20s who just began to diet, and, or they didn't call it dieting, they called it slimming, were weighing themselves either at drugstores or at university gymnasiums because they didn't yet have scales at home. In the 1920s, long sleek legs and a flat chest were a necessity for wearing a classic chemise dress, and there are lots of stories of, you know, girls, even famous feminists like Simone de Beauvoir, who bound her breasts in the 20s. Slimming becomes part of the culture, and some of that has to do with the invention of the calorie. And the first exercise salons for women in urban centers begin to appear, but nothing like the numbers that we're dealing with today. Now, by the 1940s, again, the aesthetic had changed. It's clearly anti-fat, or what I call obesophobic. There are many popular put-downs of large women, such as this postcard from the World War II era. And concerns about overweight spread to middle-class parents and to girls. This ad from 17 shows a line of special clothing for girls who are larger than normal. Note the assumption, can a chubby girl be happy? So increasingly, fat is cast as a psychological issue as well as a beauty issue. Now, in the 1950s, adult mainstream culture idealized large, pointed breasts. In the 1980s, Madonna mocked this idea of what I call mammary madness. But at the time, believe me, having read a lot of 50s diaries, it generated a lot of anxiety among young women growing up. And I heard in 50s diaries the same refrain over and over again, and it was often expressed very baldly as, I wish I could be big. And these girls are not talking about being taller and heavier. Smart marketers with the endorsement of American pediatricians began to sell training bras and foundation garments to the post-war generation, arguing that both girls and early brassieres were essential to good health and development into successful womanhood. In the 1960s, the aesthetic changed again. The national infatuation with blue jeans meant more cultural attention to thighs and buttocks, and of course, what do I find in diaries, but talk about thunder thighs. Today, at the end of the 20th century, I think it would be fair to say that adolescent girls pay close attention to both the upper body and the lower body. These are the new shoulders. It's on the poster, I think, for the series. And there's also quite a bit of attention, as in this slide, to a carefully groomed bikini line area. Contemporary young women are also piercing, not just their faces, but also their breasts and genitals, what the Victorians called private parts. I think that the historical message is really quite clear. Virtually every body part is now part of the body project, and the entire body has become a message board. Now, I want to show you at this point some contrasts. I'm not going to say very much until the last few of them that I think need a little bit of explanation. But this has primarily to do with body language, from the demure and decorous to aggressive and clearly imitating males. Those were 16-year-olds in both cases. To girls posing and playing to the camera in the 1890s with makeup in New York City. That's unusual to find a picture like that. And then today. Body language, again, sisters and chums, lots of shots like this for the 19th century, the evocation of a homosocial world, much as Carol Smith Rosenberg described it, it's still lingering into the 20th century. Today, lots of shots like that, but they have a different kind of nuance because of language. Also, of course, there are many more interracial photographs. Our relationship to the outdoors has certainly changed. These are Cornell women on the shores of Cayuga Lake, outdoors, getting their exercise, I guess. But they're in corsets and they have gloves. And this, interestingly enough, is the same spot in the 1940s where, you know, the reference is obviously from the movies of the 40s and the bathing beauties and the Busby Berkeley images. Two African-American sisters in North Carolina, really Victorian beauties, I think, and two African-American sisters, one of whom is my colleague at Cornell, from Duke not very long ago. Two Japanese-American women, very demure, in a schoolyard in San Francisco in the 40s, and this student, who is one of my favorite students, insisted that I show this in my slideshow to show you a fast-track Pacific Rim woman who's rollerblading. Okay. Athletics have obviously changed. They're a very important piece of the new body project. The routinized gymnastics of 1910, quite different from the brutal rugby scrimmage where you just can't be ladylike, you know, if you play rugby. Dating, I include this really for the, it's dear to my heart, I guess. It's not me, but I think a lot of younger people today don't realize that double dating was pushed on a lot of us in my generation, people in their 50s and their 40s, because it was thought to be safe. And this is a prom for a Catholic school in Minneapolis. The assumption was, you know, if there was a couple in the back seat and a couple in the front seat, nothing bad was really going to happen. This is dating today, you know, and all that it implies. Yearbook pictures. Well, this is a friend of mine from Ithaca, whose name, she will not allow me to announce in Ithaca who this is. I won't do it in Ann Arbor either. I'm going to show you two pictures that are 40 years apart. First of an African-American woman and then of a Caucasian woman. The point is to look at the difference in these yearbook shots. This is from the early 60s, and everybody in the class wore the same thing. In other words, the same sweater and pearls. The emphasis was on the face and personality. And this is her niece last year in Brooklyn. A much more seductive picture, would you agree? Showing a bit more flesh than in the 1950s. The picture itself has a different intention. And look at these. This is Traverse City, Michigan, right? In the 1960s, another friend of mine who shall remain nameless. And these shirts, some of you may remember, we often wore those with round pins that were called circle pins. They were an emblem of virginity. But again, you know, the emphasis is on that bright smile and on the uniformity of everybody in the class. And this is her niece last year at a high school in Connecticut, a full body shot. And of course, the reference here is to modeling, and if not every girl can do that. The next slide I show you is simply to make a point about advertising and the changes that are affecting our girls today. This is from the early 20th century, and it's a very familiar, a formulaic story. The young woman on top uses the product and gets the man. You've seen this hundreds of times. But what's interesting is she is not unhappy at the top before she uses the product. She really, you know, seems to be a relatively healthy woman. Take a look at this one. Oh, no. What happened? Hello? Can we go back to the deck slide? I'm trying to go backwards. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. There's a slide that has dropped. What it is an ad for deck styling product. And the text reads something like, if you hate your thighs because they're too jiggly, too cottage cheesy, large curve, you feel like the before and a before and after shot, it's too hereditary, blah, 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 blah. If you hate yourself, it basically says, but at least you can use deck and your hair will look good. And it's an ad that really plays on female self-hate. Okay. I chose this simply to make a point about the earlier eroticization of girls' bodies. This is a 15-year-old in the 1890s. This is a 15-year-old today from the Delia catalog. Not much different than Victoria's Secrets, and some of you should know that one of our most popular American family department stores, Penny's, has been selling bras with underwire for girls 8 and 9 for uplift. Ah, there it is. Okay, can you turn the lights on? Okay, just a few words, 5 minutes here in summary, probably a little less. Anyone who's lived or worked with adolescent girls understands the pressures that contemporary young women feel with respect to their bodies and sexuality. And thoughtful people will, I hope, be intrigued by my larger historical argument, namely that the body is always an important index of social change, and that adolescent girls, more than any other group, have absorbed the social changes in the 20th century. From a historical perspective, adolescent girls are in greater strategic difficulty than ever before because